Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, SARS sounds the alarm over 500 billion rand in unpaid taxes. Could the shortfall sink the fiscus? With ATMs disappearing nationwide, is South Africa heading for a fully cashless future? Servicing debt at the expense of growth, why South Africa is paying for its past instead of funding its future. And recycling the same leaders is not going to fix the economy. South Africa needs fresh talent at the top. It's Wednesday, the 13th of August. Johnson Makubu, Deputy Commissioner at the South African Revenue Service, has sounded the alarm over a staggering 513 billion rand in unpaid taxes owed to the fiscus. It's a figure revealed at the 12th annual tax indaba, and it raises critical concerns about fiscal health and recovery strategies. Importantly, SARS is leveraging AI, data analytics, and new VAT measures on low-value e-commerce imports to bridge a revised 1.986 trillion rand revenue target for 25-26. So I want to dig into what this means for taxpayers as well as South Africa's financial resilience. Deputy Commissioner, a very warm welcome to you. 513 billion rand, it's a lot of money. How does it compare to previous years, and what is driving its rapid escalation?
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having us. Let me say it has grown from prior years. That amount is the amount that we opened up the financial year with, i.e. 1st of April. It had grown from around 415 billion, which was the closing balance in the prior year. Largely, it's driven by two products. It's VAT and pay-as-you-earn, which you would appreciate. They are trust monies, meaning monies that pay-as-you-earn is held and collected by employers on behalf of the tax administration. But also there is VAT that also is number two in terms of the outstanding debt that we see in our books. I have to say that that obviously with any debt, it is constituted by capital amounts as well as interest and penalties. And being a tax administration, we do levy quite hefty penalties where we suspect that there is fraud or gross under declaration.
So what's the plan to plug the VAT gap?
So essentially, I mean, if we talk from a debt point of view, we will follow the normal collection strategies in terms of recovering the debt that is owed to us in terms of VAT. What we've done is we've taken a multi-pronged approach. One, we have decided to bring about 15 external debt collectors. So we've outsourced a portion of this where we believe that the debt is potentially complex and aged. Our theory is that when it becomes quite aged, it's difficult to collect. So we've brought in outsourced entities to help us collect that particular debt. We think that that is a last step that we need to consider before we can decide whether we want to make provisions for doubtful or bad debts. We've also leveraged the additional funding that the minister gave us to bring in additional resources to focus on this debt, not only VAT, but also pay-as-you-earn as a key focus area. So we're of the view that the additional resources will assist us. But Jeremy, what we are finding generally is that this debt is no longer as easy to collect. So we need to move up the compliance or the enforcement value chain in terms of moving just beyond doing third party appointments, but actually seeking civil judgments as well as writs of executions where possible, especially where the behavior of the taxpayers is not as cooperative as we would want them to, where we're not sensing cooperation, would want to intensify the instruments that we have in law to ensure that we collect those outstanding amounts.
So that's a new strategy then, as far as SARS is concerned, is that you're going to intensify legal action. Am I hearing you correctly?
Indeed. So we do understand that there are those taxpayers that will still, come to us and say, look, can I get into a compromise in line with Section 200 of the Tax Administration Act, which we are allowed to entertain? Others will come and say, look, my business is going through challenges. Can I get into deferral of payment arrangements? Again, we are open to those, having assessed the financial standing of a taxpayer to make sure that indeed their circumstances are such that we can enter into deferred arrangements in terms of the payments. But we are also finding that there are taxpayers that ignore us, and there are those that just blatantly are not complying. In there, we will then intensify our legal enforcement.
If tax debt is a balance sheet, and I think you've described it as such, from a governance standpoint, at what point do you start to write off debt to balance realism with genuine recovery?
Sure. So the Tax Administration Act does make provisions under what circumstances you should be able to either temporarily write off debt or permanently write off debt. And one of the things that is a guiding principle is whether that debt is economical to pursue. There are instances where it just becomes the rent you spend pursuing the debt is far greater than the debt you are pursuing. And under those circumstances, there's governance committees within the tax administration that guide us in terms of whether we can write that debt off. It's quite stringent. You would see that probably last year we wrote off about 36 billion rands of debt. And those are instances where we had felt that either, Jeremy, we were late to the party and a company was liquidated, or an estate was liquidated, an L&D account was offered, that institution or that entity under those circumstances actually doesn't legally exist. So it becomes quite difficult to pursue that debt amongst. I'm just painting a one category where we would say, here we need to write this off. In some instances, it's entities that were set up to defraud the fiscus. In those instances, we would go for the personal liabilities of the directors. And if those directors are either deceased or have fled the country, we would consider writing it off temporarily. And when there's activity in terms of movement in and out of the country, we would start to then say maybe it's time we reactivate that. We would report then on debt that is recovered from previous write-offs, as any other corporate would do in that regard. But we've got a very stringent governance process where if any of our debt is considered for write-off, it goes through that process, and the AG and the Ministry of Finance must be notified on an annual basis of any write-offs that the commissioner would have done, including compromises of debt that he would have entered into.
But such a path also does carry inherent risk, I imagine. So if substantial write-offs were to become necessary, the difficulty is to balance, I guess, fiscal prudence with fairness and the risk of encouraging further defaults from people who might
No,
see this
indeed,
as an open season.
indeed. I think when we consider potential write-offs, we are very clear that we are not driving behavior that may lead to deterioration in compliance levels within the environment. And that's why we generally would like to make sure that we have relied on the provisions of the law. And in some instances, Jeremy and your listeners, I must say that there are cases that are well made by colleagues that the committees believe that, before we can write this off, we actually insist that the civil judgments and writs of executions are pursued against the directors. But again, that talks to piercing the corporate veil. And sometimes it means that the debt will stay longer in our books whilst we pursue that. Unfortunately, some of the non-compliant taxpayers would really delay the process. Stalingrad techniques and tactics will be followed, which means, again, you've got a debt book that is aging whilst we pursue those. So I think from a prudence point of view, we've always insisted that at a minimum, we want the directors that perpetrated the debt against the fiscus to be personally held liable, which again becomes a legal challenge because they would stand up and they would utilize whatever resource they have to resist.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Johnston Makubu, Deputy Commissioner at the South African Revenue Service.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might have noticed that South Africa's ATMs are disappearing and disappearing fast. It seems that banks are cutting back on so-called cash machines as digital transactions surge. And that's fueling talk, obviously, of a wholly cashless future. But what happens to the millions who still rely on physical money? Could efficiency gains come at the cost of financial inclusion? It's an interesting issue, and I'm going to discuss that now with Willie Shabalala, who's head client coverage, personal and private banking at Standard Bank. Willie, a very warm welcome to you. What, in your opinion, then, is driving this rapid reduction of ATM numbers across South Africa?
I think it's twofold. The digital uptake by our clients and customers, it's on the increase, because as banks, certainly as Standard Bank, we have invested quite considerably in elevating our digital platforms to enhance client experience, and we have seen the uptake resulting in our clients relying less on cash, and hence, as the cash demands are slowed down in some of our environments, we continue to revisit to ensure that our ATMs are fit for purpose. We place them in environments where there's a big uptake or big demands. But we have also, over the years, partnered with some of the retailers where our clients are able to withdraw cash. So, they don't just rely on our own platforms, so they can access cash via retailers if there is a need for cash. But I think the digital uptake the use of online capability has resulted in lesser demand for some of the cash requirements.
It's all about the march of progress, obviously, and I understand cost and efficiency. But as far as the financial services sector is concerned, all, I imagine, part of a maybe medium-term deliberate shift towards a cashless society?
No, spot on. I think as an industry, we need to align and move on with the times, because if our customers are saying, reduce the amount of risk by me carrying cash, then the digital uptake, it's a given. And how do we make it seamless? How do we ensure that, through various technology that clients might be utilizing, from cell phones, as an example, how do we enable that? Because not everyone owns a smartphone. So, we are able to, even if you are a non-smartphone user, you are able to be active in the digital world from transacting, as it were. And I think that's what it's increasing that. And certainly as an industry, it's more around how do we also ensure that we improve the associated security requirements, so that we increase the level of comfort from our customer base, so that the uptake is at the required level.
Let's get to risk if we can in just a moment, but I do understand your argument about partnership and also about smartphones. But there is a risk, surely, of excluding rural communities or those without access to digital banking tools. And again, the financial services sector must be cognizant of this.
No, absolutely. So as I've indicated, you'll be amazed that even people without a smartphone, they do engage in banking, because we do have services that you can access using a non-smartphone technology, whereby the uptake, the big issue for us, it's educating our clients, showing them how to drive level of comfort. And with us being deliberate in terms of educating our clients, showing them how to access such services, we have seen the uptake being on the increase. Whether you talk people from remote environments, you'll be amazed that the uptake is on the increase, because of the associated risk of carrying cash. But as I said, where there's still a bigger cash demand, we do still, place our ATMs in such environments so that we create convenience for our clients.
Uptake might be on the increase, but with ongoing power problems in many parts of South Africa, and I don't need to tell you about patchy connectivity, do you think a fully cashless system can actually work reliably?
I think it's probably a combination of the two, Jeremy, if you ask me, because I don't see us being a fully cashless, but I see us being having a higher digital uptake. As an example, there's another bank we have ensured that all our ATMs have got backup power, which means when technology fails in terms of connectivity, our clients can still engage using our ATM network. We have invested quite considerably in terms of refreshing our assets and so far as our ATMs are concerned. So I think these must coexist as far as I'm concerned, leaning more towards the digital uptake.
And do cashless economies make banking cheaper for customers or more profitable for banks?
It's about accessibility as far as we're concerned, because we know that there will always be demand from some of our society for cash, and how do we ensure that where there's demand for cash, it's accessible? Because it's also, you will appreciate that for clients to go and withdraw cash, they will have spent money traveling there to go and utilize, go and withdraw that cash. And certainly when they are on using digital technology, it costs them less because they are able to transact without having to go and get cash in environments where cash is it's not a requirement. So as I say, it's that balanced approach to ensure that there's a win-win from a client's perspective, because they are able to access services, pay for them without having to go to, to an ATM and having to carry cash as it were.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Willie Shabalala, who is Head Client Coverage, Personal and Private Banking at Standard.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, one in every 6 rand spent by government now goes to paying debt interest, not to education or to health or to infrastructure. That is a sizable amount. As the cost of debt balloons, South Africa is falling behind on investment as far as the future is concerned. There's a big focus on South Africa's young, and the question I guess that we need to ask is the next generation. Is it being shortchanged? I want to weigh in on this subject with Setlogane Mantshidi from Investec. He's the head of CSI at the institution. So, Setlogane, welcome to you. How serious, in your opinion, then, is this debt trap? And specifically to your area of interest, is there a real tangible impact on education?
Jeremy, thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity. I mean, I think in every sense in the country, all service delivery related kind of requests are under pressure. It'll be health, it'll be many other spaces, but in education is no exception. Indeed, we have seen a contraction from a budgeting perspective, both in terms of the budget as a percentage of GDP or as a percentage of overall allocation, budget allocation to education. We've seen a contraction. And unfortunately, that's projected to continue for quite some time. And undeniably, such pressures financially are going to result in difficulty in delivering quality education. And even more so, suffice to say, I would go as far as arguing that it would perpetuate inequality in the South African context.
Is it a simplistic argument to say that we're paying creditors at the cost of classrooms?
It's not a simplistic argument. It's true. He was taking from Peter to give to Paul. And unfortunately, taking from Peter in this instance is taking from education that's meant to contribute to future role players, active economic participants, people who can drive this country forward. And that's the unfortunate part, that when you take away from education, you're actually shooting yourself in the foot.
So if the trajectory continues, then what is the future of those future role players, do you think?
I think the future of these role players is bleak. One, let's just take it in most simplistic terms. We obviously have a huge percentage of our budget, education budget, going to human resources, which is teachers. And you would have heard, even last year already in 2024, that different provinces, Western Cape being amongst the first one, that announced early on already to the extent to which they had to cut about 15,000 posts just because there was a shortfall, a funding shortfall in terms of the budget allocation in education. Now, that comes in a context where the teacher-learner ratio in this country is already very challenged. We have serious overcrowding in our classrooms. We cannot afford to lose more teachers. Now, overcrowding, by the way, we know, given the space that we play in maths and science, that it is the main reason why, it's one of the main reasons anyway, why we perform poorly in maths and science, because our learners are in overcrowded classrooms, and then they're also taught by inadequately qualified teachers. And if you shrink the allocation to teachers, then you haven't got the flexibility to appoint the adequately qualified maths and science teachers.
So there's no doubt that we're at some kind of urgent tipping point here. Is there any way in which we can shield the education sector from rising debt cost, or do you think it's too late?
Well, I'm not too sure. I mean, as it is, Jeremy, we've got to also acknowledge that relative to emerging economies, South Africa spends, as it is, way too much more in education, right? Of course, we're talking to the shrinkage in education budgets, but actually compared to many other emerging economies, we are spending quite a fortune. In fact, the challenge here is the quality, the output, what we get out of it is not commensurate with what we spend, right? So it really talks to the need to look at the inefficiencies within our system. Right? Actually, perhaps this is a wake-up call. Perhaps this is about high time that we start. Of course, we can't afford to shrink budgets, but also we can't afford to spend willy-nilly and not understanding to what end. Really got to critically evaluate the extent to which, just think the issue of ghost teachers. I mean, it's ghost public servants. This is a challenge that continues to exist even today. I don't even think the department can tell you as to how many of these who are supposedly earning a salary are ghost teachers, right? That talks to inefficiencies within our system. We really have to question long and hard to say, yes, of course, the fiscal position is tight, but perhaps in the fiscal position being tight, it's an opportune time to ask, are we getting bang for our buck?
Ghost teachers aside, obviously there is a need for a return on investment as far as spending is concerned. How do you think then we mine more deeply into those inefficiencies to find some kind of outcome?
You know, one of the biggest pieces, which I'm sure I'll be almost shot for suggesting, is of course there are very good teachers out there. They are very good teachers. They're very good, hardworking teachers. But at the same time, there are teachers who are just passengers, I have to say. And what we've really got to critically introduce in this country is a strict performance management system of our educators. We have to. And I say I'm going to literally be shot because I don't think unions and others might agree with me. But if we're really being critical and hard and honest with ourselves, these are some of the things we have to do, is to say we cannot afford to carry dead wood. Right. And especially in a country where there are unemployed teachers at the moment, in the same way as you would have seen protests of unemployed doctors. Right. You cannot afford, because in order to ensure that we are spending our money wisely, we have to link it tightly with the quality of education and the outcomes thereof.
So let me bring this conversation to an end. First of all, let me say, I don't think anyone's going to shoot you, Setlogane, for amplifying a very important issue. Just briefly, what role then does the private sector have to play in this beyond just CSI spend?
I mean, I think one of the biggest pieces, which is a lost opportunity for me, that I think we could have coordinated better between government and business, is the understanding of the National Development Plan as a blueprint in terms of what we're working towards, and to rally everybody, including all corporate entities, participation in pursuit of this. It is drawn, it is made reference to, but I don't think we operationally championed it and said 2030, these are the kind of the targets, these are kind of aspirations, and therefore, if these are aspirations, what are we collectively, citizenry, corporates, government, and anybody else going to do, and what are going to be objectives that we're going to be assessing year on year in terms of how well or how bad we're doing. That hasn't happened. And I think that's a lost opportunity. So if there's anything that the corporate sector and anybody else can do, is to really ask themselves hard questions around how do we together, and maybe the national dialogue, the conversations that are about to emerge, will take us there, that we need to get into a space of collaborating, not for the sake of collaborating, but in pursuit of clearly identified aspirations, objectives, and goals, which I would have thought that the National Development Plan would have represented fairly well.
Setlogane Mantshidi is the head of CSI at Investec. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now let's move on to this, and this is an interesting observation. A leadership deficit, and not necessarily policy or funding, is potentially what is holding South Africa back. That's a very blunt and honest message from Tuesday Consulting, who warns that recycling the same underperforming leaders across public and private institutions is possibly stalling national progress. At the heart of the issue, broken trust, weak accountability, and a failure to prioritize ethical, courageous leadership. I want to talk about this with Tolofelo Nketane, who's director at Tuesday Consulting, and let's find out why fixing this leadership pipeline is now a national imperative. Tolofelo, you raise a very important and interesting issue here. What do you mean when you say that the country has a leadership deficit? What's your assessment or your explanation for that?
What we meant was, based on the observation, because Tuesday Consulting, we privy to leadership conversation that happened behind closed doors. And what's coming out of those conversations, Jeremy, is a concern that the same visible leaders are being circulated across institutions, even when sort of evidence suggests otherwise, right? And I feel like it is a leadership renewal issue that needs to be addressed. It's important that, you know, we challenge the cycle and we call on more courageous, value-based leaders and when we're making leadership appointment. And really what's driving this deficit, Jeremy, for us is, you know, it comes out of the deep fear of disruption, a narrow perspective of looking at leadership. Many institutions, especially those under pressure, make decisions based on familiarity because of safety. So board and decision makers tend to reach for individuals within their networks or people they've worked with before, not necessarily because they're the best fit, but they feel the safest choice reputationally or relationally. And we've got to challenge that cycle.
I understand your fear of disruption argument, and it makes perfect sense. But is it also potentially a lack of the right people to fill the vacuum?
Jeremy, for me, it's the lack of making leadership decisions at exco level and at board level. It is also that organizations, when they, you know, what we see is the appointment of a leader, it is not an HR process. It is actually a strategic and a board decision, or a strategic decision. So employing traditional acquisition processes will not help make those tough decisions. You know, organizations need to be a little bit more innovative and partner with, you know, the likes of Tuesday Consulting, who employ a little bit of a broad and a rigorous approach that, you know, you're not looking at just filling roles, but you are positioning and aligning, you know, the appointment of your leader with your strategic objective of a long term, rather than looking at just a short term sort of tick box.
Solofele, you used the word courage a little earlier in the conversation. How then do you convince boards to develop that and maybe take a leap of faith?
So courage is also built through using processes that inform your decision-making processes. So like going back to, you know, our, you know, search processes, we produce data. We are able to give you data to be able to inform how you make those decisions, because they're not just made on your fear or what looks familiar to you or what you've worked with, but what does industry look like? What does leadership trends look like? And we are able to share all of that information in terms of what are the trends saying from a leadership perspective, what are the analytics saying in terms of the demographics, the you know, the gender, the race, what individuals have done in the industry, and also then that facilitates your ability to you know, to make those decisions. That it's not internal focus, but rather there is some data that drives your decision making process.
So if they let's talk a little bit about consequence, if we can. If we're seeing the same faces, whether it be the public sector or the private sector, that is going to have an impact on profitability and performance, I imagine. Do you have data to support that?
Correct. I mean, ultimately, you know, we always say, Jeremy, that, you know, systems, even though they are there, are best. They, you know, you need an individual, you need a human being to be able to interpret those systems and to interpret what, you know, has been inputted and put out to be able to facilitate and help the individual make those courageous decisions and leadership decisions.
Do you think the cycle of using the same people also has an impact on trust, whether it be a public institution or a private company?
Absolutely. I mean, ultimately, appointing the right leaders builds trust within any organization and within the team that you are leading. You know, people want to know that they are not only getting a credible or competent leader, but a leader that would be able to make the right and tough decisions. Ultimately, it's about, you know, meeting the organizational strategy. And how I look at that organizational strategy is that one organization meets its strategic objectives, it has a ripple effect on the industry and ultimately on the overall sector and or country.
All very well looking for new faces, but there's also a problem with reference checks and integrity vetting, which is still not happening. And there have been a litany of scandals in that respect.
Absolutely. And, you know, hence, you know, processes such as where Tuesday Consulting is involved, we really believe in, you know, doing all of that, you know, due diligence checks, where it is not necessarily just sitting with an individual across the table and having a conversation, but really verifying the information that the individual is giving you. So we do extensive, you know, due diligence by doing formal and informal references, which are independent. We conduct also psychometric assessments for a 360 view of an individual and comprehensive.
And Solofele, kudos to your company for doing that. But the point I'm trying to make is that it is not happening in a broad spectrum, is it?
It is where I'm coming from and where I'm sitting, Jeremy. It is happening, provided the organization is using the right processes to be able to do that due diligence. Hence, it is critical not to shortchange the process and rather invest in the process to be able to, you know, get all of that, you know, checks done.
So finally, then, what's your one call to action to decision makers who will still prioritize loyalty over leadership?
My advice is, you know, invest in the leadership decision. We often find that boards are looking for certainty in uncertain times. But at the end of the day, it's around employing the right processes around acquiring leaders. Because when you then prioritize your leadership decision or your leadership appointment, then you are solving a long-term strategic objective rather than a short-term objective.
It's a very important conversation. Let's see if something comes out of it. Solofele Nkatani, thank you very much indeed, Director at Tuesday Consulting. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.